what you experience is a function of your predictions and reality. So predictions times reality. You know, and if we are caught in our own minds, the predictions end up determining most of our experience. Mindfulness tethers us back to real reality. And by being in reality, most of the catastrophes that we're fearing are not in that reality. They're in the prediction part. So like most of the basis for worry goes away simply by being present with what is.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimalwork.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass, which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimalwork.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, great to be back here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, great to be back.
Yeah, Kevin, well, I thought we could do an episode on mindfulness. And even though in its practice, it's, I think, the simplest thing we teach people, it's actually conceptually very difficult. And maybe those two things are related. But there was also a recent, well, actually 5 years ago, an article by some pretty well-known people in the field on the paradoxes of mindfulness that I think could provide a good basis for this discussion.
Great. Let's go into it.
Okay. So as I mentioned, yeah, the article is The Paradoxes of Mindfulness. And actually one of the authors there is at Harvard. I don't know if you've had the chance to meet him or talk with him.
I haven't met him, but no, yeah, Ron Siegel is quite famous in psychotherapy for his many, many works and publications on mindfulness and psychotherapy. And he's an assistant clinical professor at Harvard Med School too. So.
Yep. And then the other authors are Shauna Shapiro and Kristen Neff. And then, so they present four paradoxes of mindfulness, which is interesting. And so the first one is... what is it? Acceptance versus change. So the idea that in mindfulness, and this is one thing we talk about a lot, is accepting difficult emotions, accepting reality, versus also, I think people approach mindfulness with the idea of, hey, this is part of a program of personal growth and personal development. So are you accepting what is, or are you trying to change what is? You know, so that's one of the paradoxes. And then
that's a great point. Should we dive in on that one first?
Yeah, let's just take them one by one. That sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the number one problem people have in understanding how to use mindfulness. Because if you're going to do something, say 10 minutes a day, you need to have a sense of what's the benefit you want to get out of it. Why would I invest all this time if it's not going to somehow make me better, make me feel better? Make me think better, make me work better, whatever you think. There has to be some goal that you have for how this is going to improve your life. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. And so there could be this sense then that when people go to do mindfulness, they want something to happen then and there. Now, if you think of mindfulness as a form of patience, that in its capacity to simply be with the pain that may be present, and be willing to suffer that pain. Patience is the willingness to suffer. So it seems like that's an incredibly essential part of mindfulness as an assistant for becoming patient. That it teaches us how to suffer pain without fighting it. So without somehow resisting it too much. They cite this idea that I like a lot, that resistance leads to persistence. And if you resist something, it could be like a thought you don't want to have, or a memory keeps coming back, or whatever it might be, some impulse. The more you effortfully start fighting it, trying to keep it from your mind, the more it persists. So patience is learning how to suffer these things without getting complicated by them. Like to let them be there is essentially to let them come and go. But you could exercise mindfulness impatiently. And you see this especially when people try to use it as a way of combating anxiety. So if you think of it as an anti-anxiety tool, you're thinking of it wrong. So, and this is the hardest thing sometimes to help people see that, in fact, far from being anti-anxiety, mindfulness in a way is pro-anxiety. It's pro-feeling it. It's pro-feeling it as fully as you can whenever it shows up. That actually does the work of habituating it. So the paradox is, the more open you are to anxiety, the more quickly it comes and goes and runs its course. And that's true, I think, of most forms of pain, particularly emotional pain.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. So when you're talking about mindfulness, I guess it's not necessarily its own kind of activity, although you can just dedicate 10 minutes to mindfulness, but also it's just a way of attending to reality and a kind of focus on, you know, one thing or certain things outside you, as opposed to, actually, it's interesting, they talk a lot about the default mode network, which is something we focus on. So I'm sure we'll get there. But instead of just letting your internal chatter kind of dominate and your default way of doing things, your automatic responses. So it's this way of kind of, you know, building a buffer. So do you think that I think part of one of the ways they present mindfulness is it's an activity that's good for its own sake. It's just good to be mindful. So it's not necessarily that it has to be some skill that you develop for the sake of something else. Like, I want to get really mindful so that I can focus better and make a lot of money at my job. But they're just saying, no, it's good to be mindful, to be aware in a more deliberate and open way of reality. I mean, so do you buy that at all?
I do. I think that mindfulness is maybe what would classically be called a human virtue. It's a positive habit of mind that is used for good and not for bad. So I think that this kind of habit of mind is an excellence that humans are capable of attaining, but it's not an excellence that we're born with. So it's like every other virtue. We are born with the capacity to become like this, but it's not necessarily there. And I don't think you can reach the height of human excellence from a virtue's perspective without mindfulness being very integral to that whole thing. So I think the people we would look up to the most, you would say, would be people who were not lost in their thoughts. They weren't tied up in daydreaming or in worrying or ruminating. And they were able to be kind of in contact with reality. So, and they could see reality with a kind of clarity. So there are all these great qualities that we can have. In a way, the virtues are ends, because I think human perfectibility is an end. So I think ultimately it's about bonds, and those are the real end. But I think that certainly you could think of, like, is a person who has mindfulness more capable of forming bonds with others? Well, absolutely. You know, I think the bond is a kind of habitual attention, and mindfulness is actual attention. So bonds are built by being mindful of each other. So whatever you would say is the highest end for human nature, mindfulness is a part of that. And that's why it's an end in itself. Now, the practice of mindfulness, like doing meditation, that is, I think, a means to an end. So you can distinguish between the practice of meditation in a mindful way versus this quality of being mindful, which I think is integral to so many of the virtues.
Mm-hmm. They talk about, I guess, how they reconcile, it seems to me, in this article, is that in mindfulness, you're just accepting reality, but also that you're doing it to change, is that that capacity to just be open to reality and to not let your thoughts and your, you know, prejudices or something dominate everything that dominate your perceptions and your way of acting, is that just attending to reality is kind of the foundation from which you can take deliberate action and actually improve and grow and learn and practice and do all these good things. Is that kind of how you see things, that mindfulness is the basis for right action, and that's like where it's fulfilled?
Yeah, and I think you would say then that it's an essential part of prudence. You know, that your thinking is actually grounded in reality. So it goes back to this idea that we talk about sometimes, that what you experience is a function of your predictions and reality. So predictions times reality. You know, and if we are caught in our own minds, the predictions end up determining most of our experience. Mindfulness tethers us back to real reality. And by being in reality, most of the catastrophes that we're fearing are not in that reality. They're in the prediction part. So like most of the basis for worry goes away simply by being present with what is and learning to accept the degree of uncertainty that there is at the present moment. So being like, so in a way, acceptance is the change you're trying to help people to have.
Wonderful. Well, Kevin, maybe we can move on to then the second proposed paradox, which is escape versus engagement. And just to summarize their idea here, on the one hand, it seems like if you're anxious or you have some negative emotion, that you would use mindfulness as a way of calming yourself down and kind of retreating within yourself so you don't have to experience mm-hmm. the challenge anymore. But at the same time, we're trying to use mindfulness to engage the challenges. So how do we find balance between those two, you know, ways of using mindfulness in the face of a challenge? Are we using it to escape challenge or to engage challenge?
Yeah, and that to me is a little more confusing, because what they propose is that, in fact, you use it temporarily to escape and then later to engage. And I don't think that's actually the right, just understanding how the amygdala works. I don't think that's the right understanding of escape and approach, because you could also say approach instead of engagement. So you have escape and approach are these, every human behavior is judged by your amygdala to be in one of those categories. Everything you do, your amygdala thinks that you are either approaching a challenge or avoiding a challenge. So I would think that mindfulness would allow one to be more present to the challenge. So whatever you were going to end up doing, then you would do mindfully. And so if you're approaching it, you would be mindful of the alarm sounding more as you approach. So, but I don't see how, unless it's good to escape it, I think you could, if it's some dangerous thing that you need to escape, I guess that could be done mindfully too. It's not the normal way we think of mindfulness as being used in emergencies that where your life is at risk. But I would say that there you're talking about behaviors, and mindfulness, I think, can only be like an adverb at that point. You could escape mindfully or approach mindfully, but doesn't tell you which one to do. And this is where you start to get to what I think are the limits of mindfulness. You know, that mindfulness does not make a judgment regarding what you're experiencing. In fact, it is a habit of non-judgmentally like tuning in, welcoming the being of all that is. So that's why I don't see it really relevant to escape and engagement. It is a form of engagement always. So I think it, like, mindfulness follows the reframe. So if you can see that, hey, this would be great training for my alarm, because I know that I'm too afraid of heights, and so I'm going to go onto this safe but high balcony, bring it on. This will be my best training. Well, then mindfulness completes the bring it on by feeling it fully. So you have the intellectual part that's the reframe, and then you have the attentional part, which is mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. What if you limit the kind of arena of mindfulness to just be your internal world, so that maybe when you have difficult emotions, it's about mindfulness could be a way to escape those emotions in particular. So maybe it's not the external trigger of those emotions, but you're mm-hmm. using mindfulness to, as they say, the purpose of mindfulness is to achieve equanimity. So you're yeah. trying to kind of calm the storm internally.
Yeah, I think what they're trying to do there is say it's like defining equanimity as first being impatient, then being patient. So equanimity is both impatience and patience. But I don't think that's right. I think patience and equanimity here are the same thing. So I don't think temporarily avoiding what you're experiencing is like the right way to balance escape and engagement as a dynamic or a process within mindfulness. So I think there's a little bit of clarity that could need to be further drawn out on what does mindfulness tell us about the need to escape or engage. And I don't think that it makes that judgment. And that's because I don't think it's the whole of the person. I don't think that you utilize the whole of your mind in mindfulness. I think that's why I think it's important that we also have an intellect that can make these judgments. But mindfulness is not primarily the act of the intellect, it's the attention. So you could say it's the intellect attending to being, or you could say it's memory attending to being, but it's the attention to being itself. And that's what attention, particularly task attention, is always doing. And mindfulness is an exercise that highly activates task attention within us, which is the part of our attention that tunes into being. But it's not really the same part that is going to be making automatic or deliberate judgments about whether something should be approached or avoided.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Kevin, do you want to move on to the third one then?
Yeah.
Okay. So the third one is effort versus non-striving. And mm-hmm. I think the idea here is that mindfulness is supposed to be a kind of peaceful state where you're kind of just there, you know, your mind is quiet. So there's a kind of sense that there's a non-striving. You're not really trying to accomplish anything. You're trying to just be there in a peaceful state of mind. And yet at the same time, this is kind of difficult because anyone who's tried mindfulness knows that you start getting thoughts popping in your head and you kind of have the sense, okay, I have to get rid of them in order to be in my mindful state. So how does one balance this sort of non-striving, not trying to judge, not trying to accomplish anything, which is at the same time requires a lot of effort?
Yeah, they talk about the neuroscientist who did a year-long silent retreat. And for the first 6 months, he said it was just bliss. But then he had some kind of family business he had to go take care of. And so he flew back to the U.S. and then he went back to finish the year. And he said the second 6 months were very painful because he kept trying to get back to the state he had in the first 6 months. It wasn't until he realized he had to let go of that striving and simply be with whatever is that eventually it came back. I remember also taking part in this, Daniel Brown back, I think it was in 2011, I went to a conference he gave. He's a Harvard psychologist. And it was a conference on visualization and peak performance, which is where so many ideas about flow were. It was my first exposure to many of these subtle nuances and thinking ways of thinking about flow. At any rate, he did this exercise where you sit in silence and you try to imagine your mind as being completely blank and black, and then the moment a thought starts elaborating, you try to see the thought as a little flame of a candle being lit in your mind. And the moment that happens, you snuff it out. And then you wait for the next one. And what happens is you find that if we all did this together, like 2,000 people, there was some huge conference. We did this for like 10 minutes or something. And what you find is that at first, you do may need to make more effort to snuff out. So you're kind of watching for the thoughts to elaborate and then snuffing them out kind of dutifully. But then you realize that the less effort you make, the less the candle, the flame comes. So you can actually attain more lasting silence by not striving. But still you're ready to snuff it out should something come. So I think that there are these phases we go through. I have to say that I felt like I had laser-like focus for an entire week after doing it that one time. It hasn't been something I've practiced regularly, but it was very powerful. So I think that there are kind of phases in mindfulness practice where in the initial stage, you have to be setting an anchor for yourself. And that takes a little bit of effort. And then you have to be ready to set up the detecting intruding thoughts and then let go of them when they come and re-anchor yourself. The setup takes some effort initially. As you get more practice with it, and as your default mode network in the background, your default attention gets better at realizing what you're doing, it gives you less and less new thoughts, or fewer and fewer new thoughts. So as you're doing that then, it becomes easier to have no effort. Mindfulness is different than flow, though. Flow is the state of effortless attention. But I think you can have flow within mindfulness to some extent. It's such a subtle thing, though, of learning not to overstrive, and now that starts making your default attention generate predictions of what you're trying to accomplish, and your mind gets filled with thoughts. So you have to find just the right level of effort so that it doesn't generate new thoughts. So, and at the beginning, it seems like a tiny little like eye of a needle to get a thread through, but it gets bigger and bigger with practice so that you kind of learn how to get to that space where you're not striving, not over striving.
Well, one of the things, the benefits of mindfulness that I emphasize is that it teaches you how to engage with distractions at work. So if you're just sitting there and you're trying to keep your mind quiet and then a new thought arises, the ability to kind of handle that deliberately, and maybe it's an urge to check your phone or to watch YouTube, and the ability to just handle that deliberately and let it go, to overcome it or to resist it or whatever word you want to use. Maybe resist isn't, maybe letting it go is the best. That mindfulness is teaching you that skill. So then when you're working and you get distracted, okay, maybe I want to check my phone now, you can resist that too, or let that thought go, let that urge go. But now we're introducing another idea in mindfulness, which is kind of a striving for a totally peaceful, no new thoughts state. So how does that relate to the previous practice I described, where actually you kind of want the new thoughts to come up so you can practice letting them go?
Yeah, so the new thoughts are the practice, but the fruit of the practice is you get fewer and fewer new thoughts. So, and as a flow state, it is enjoyable. And it's more enjoyable depending on what is the anchor for your attention. So in some senses, the more rich the anchor of your attention is, then the more enjoyable that state is.
Yeah, if it's your breath, that's kind of interesting, I suppose. But if it's your work, that's more interesting. And if it's another person, that's the most. And is that what you're taught?
Yeah.
What you mean?
Yeah. And it can also be the movements of your own heart. So it can be the sense of life within you. It can be sense of your active being. It can be the love in your heart. So that in all of these things, you can use these anchors. And in some way or other, every tradition of prayer and mindfulness, that's what they teach people to do.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, Kevin, I think we're coming to our last paradox, which is also the most controversial one.
That's right.
Which is the self versus non-self, or focus on self versus non-self.
And I guess here the paradox for them is that on the one hand, in mindfulness, it seems like you're just focused on yourself, you know, my thoughts, my breath, and so on. But at the same time, in some way, the goal is to be selfless. And they use kind of weird phrases, which I don't particularly like, of like gaining a kind of freedom from your own self, or losing your own self, or realizing that your own self doesn't exist, which I think is a kind of Buddhist influence there. But I think there is this kind of paradox at the core of the practice, which is that in one sense, you're focusing on yourself, but that the goal is to kind of transcend yourself. Actually, we touched on this paradox a long time ago when we discussed Maslow's hierarchy, right? Where at the top of the pyramid, you have this, I forget, Kevin, what's at the top of the pyramid?
Self-actualization.
Self-actualization, which leads to self-transcendence. So he kind of identifies those two things. Yeah. So it seems like maybe there's a similar paradox going on here.
Yeah. So at one level, talking about the default mode network in this context as being the chatter in your head. So it's all the self-referential thoughts that we have. Because in fact, when we are ruminating about things or turning things over again and again in our head, we're always, those are always self-referential. So this has been a longstanding thing in psychology, the self-referential nature of these types of thoughts, the chatter in the head. Okay. Well, we know that mindfulness basically, as you practice it, as we were just talking about, gradually silences the default mode network. So that default attention goes quiet while task attention is fully activated. So in one sense, yeah, by focusing on the sensation of your breath or your life or your act of being, you end up silencing self-referential thoughts. Really what you're doing is you're silencing the modeling of self, which is what's happening. It's like a left brain process of self-modeling, the self-image. So you experience yourself simply as you are. In that sense, I think mindfulness is an integral part of humility. It kind of, that's like humility is just a deepening of the mode of mindfulness, so that you're aware of yourself as you exist and others as they exist. So I think that it does mean you're actually forgetful of self. So while attending to you, to what is, I think the height of humility is feeling all that exists in you as an effect, so that you're not the cause of it yourself. But then to say that there you have no being, to say that there is no self, is to say that there is no cause of you. And it would actually vacate the object of mindfulness itself. And to say that really it's no being, or it's one unibeing. But if there's no being, if there's no self, there can be no reframe either. So there's no ideal to strive for. You know, you would end up emptying, because I think one's own growth and then the bonds one has with others would both get vacated by getting rid of your true sense of self. Because it's the true self that grows, and it's the true self that bonds with others. So not the model. So I think they mistake the model for the self. And the proof of that is their quoting their discussion of IFS, internal family systems. And they think that IFS is simply in IFS that the self is the sum of the parts. At least that's all I can gather, because they don't mention true self at all. And they would make you think that IFS is realizing that you have all these parts, but none of them are in fact you. And so therefore nothing is real. But that's the opposite of IFS. IFS is that you are the origin of the parts, that the true self, in fact, is the origin of the exile and its protectors. So the proactive ones and the reactive ones. So so I think that in IFS, there is an understanding that the true self is where the growth takes place, the growth in courage and confidence and clarity. And it brings that to these parts to heal them and restore them into the unity of the self. Now, not to make this all about IFS, but it's just interesting that the true self is, that's why it's called self-therapy. Like That's the book by Jay Early that I think is the best one. What would be, where would self-therapy be if there was no self? So I think that in that end, the whole thing kind of collapses. If there's no self, then there's no real subject for psychology to even operate on.
Yeah. So the proper way to resolve this tension that they've introduced is, I think, the idea of the self model, which you mentioned early on in your response, that what you're doing is trying to get detach yourself from the self model, not to
the self image
destroy your own identity or something. It's like if you're constantly looking in the mirror, you know, the default mode is kind of like a mirror in your brain or something, where you're is constantly looking at an image of yourself, or them is like, well, just stop looking at the mirror, but that doesn't mean that you disappear. You know, it's just the image of you has, you don't see it anymore.
And the more central a person's self-image is, one fun fact that I've heard, that there's a study that showed this, I'm not sure how they did it, but they could tell how central your own self-image was to your experience of yourself by giving you a white piece of paper, totally blank, have you draw yourself as a figure on the paper and label it me. And the size of the figure and the size of me actually went with how fully occupied your field of view was by yourself. So I actually believe it, even though I have no idea how you'd really prove it. And that's the idea, is like what you're trying to do is shrink the self model, like the self image, which is a defense against shame. And so we develop this part of us as a defense against shame, and humility is shame acceptance. And so as you do that, in fact, it shrinks. So, and on that page, I guess the more humble you were, the more your actual, you know, the stick figure with me would get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Fascinating. Well, Kevin, I think we've covered all the main points of this article, so, which is great. And we're basically out of time now. So I don't know if you want to leave us with a final thought.
I briefly touched on this idea that there is mindfulness as the quality, the virtue. And then there's this practice you can do of, say, you know, 10 minutes or so a day. And I have seen really great results, you know, from people being able to do 10 minutes a day, even after just 1 week. And there are measurable changes that on the stuff we're working on when I'm seeing them in therapy. I've come across a new way, and this might be a good another podcast topic, of microdosing mindfulness, which is you basically find an object. It could be a person. It could be a representation of a person. It could be anything that's deeply meaningful to you. And as you inhale, you lock your attention and try to take in everything about that. And you really hold your attention and just wait and wait as you're inhaling. And then you slowly exhale and keep your attention fully locked on that thing. It takes about, you know, 10 to 15 seconds. And you do that a few times a day. And the effect is people experience each day then being more and more mindful. They're spontaneously hit with the beauty of things around them and the people around them. And they have much greater sense of awe. So who knows what the least, like, what's the minimum effective dose of mindfulness as an intervention? I don't know yet, but that's really interesting. So maybe we'll talk about that again.
Fascinating. Yeah, let's do it. Great, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining me for this discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Sharif.
All right, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.